I'm Lillian Vasquez with Lifestyles on KVCR. Thanks for listening. On today's show, I'm checking in with local nonprofits to find out how they've been doing during this pandemic. So I'll speak with Jessica Munoz, Executive Director of Voices for Children in Riverside County. Voices for Children offers a CASA program, court-appointed special advocates who work closely with foster children to ensure their needs are met. Jessica shares how they serve foster children, how to become a CASA volunteer, and the changes they've had to implement during this year. Also on the show, I'll speak with Adam Monahan, a longtime producer of the popular PBS show Antiques Roadshow, which airs on KVCR-TV Fridays at 8 p.m. Adam is also the host of the new podcast, Detours, a project which takes a slight detour from Antiques Roadshow. But up first, my conversation with Jessica Munoz. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Here at KVCR, we're making a real effort to check in with nonprofits in our region to see how they're doing during this pandemic and if they're able to keep their doors open. But first, share what CASA stands for, what CASA stands for, and what its mission is.
CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocate. At Voices for Children, we are the Court-Appointed Special Advocate, or CASA program, for Riverside County.
What is the role of a court-appointed special advocate?
Court-appointed special advocates, or CASAs, are community volunteers who are appointed by juvenile court judges to advocate for children or sibling groups who are living in foster care. A lot of people we meet are surprised to know that when a child is removed from their home due to abuse or neglect, a judge is assigned to oversee the case and make decisions about everything that will happen next. And that's where Voices for Children has a really special role to play. We have the privilege of training and then providing ongoing support to CASA volunteers in Riverside County.
Okay, so let's talk about some of that training. Who can be a volunteer and what's the process?
All of our volunteers come from lots of different backgrounds with lots of different experiences, and we love it that way. Our kids are diverse, so we need people from all walks of life to come alongside and support them. Volunteers are required to be at least 21 years of age or older, and as I can imagine you would expect, we have to background check and screen all of our volunteers, of course. But other than that, really anyone with a heart for kids and a willingness to make an 18-month commitment would be welcome to serve as a volunteer. Volunteers then participate in a 35-hour training program, which we have shifted to an online platform during the pandemic so that they will receive some training and education about foster care as well as their role of a CASA. And then all of our volunteers are assigned to a paid professional member of our staff to provide them with ongoing guidance and support.
All right. So tell me what that training looks like. Is that what the Advocate University is? Is that where they're getting their training?
Yes. So our pre-service training curriculum is called Advocate University. It's 35 hours. Half of that time is self-paced. And then half of it is in live format. Right now we're using Zoom, as so many are. Prior to the pandemic, that would have been time spent in the classroom. Thanks to the technology that we have available to us, we've been able to shift that to a live online-based learning format.
What are the types of things they're learning when they're in those 35 hours? What do they leave with after they've attended the 35 hours?
Our volunteers receive training in a wide variety of topics, from child development, to advocating for a child's educational needs, to understanding the child welfare system and the court process. We also talk a lot about how to develop and nurture relationships, not only with the child, but also with the other adults in the child's life, like their parents, caregivers, attorneys, and social workers. And of course, we want to make sure that our CASAs are prepared for their role. So we provide them with guidance on our policies and procedures, as well as information on how to write the court reports that they'll be submitting at least twice a year to the judge assigned to the child's case.
In that they're responsible to write something, what are they responsible for the year or the 18 months that you said the commitment? If someone is listening and they think, yep, I could do that, or maybe that's not for me, what's their role?
So our CASAs will communicate or visit with their child at least once a month. So from the child's perspective, the CASA volunteer becomes a caring, consistent adult presence that they can count on as a source of support, someone that they can share the things that they're excited about that happen in their day, and someone that they can reach out to if they need help or are having a problem. From the court's perspective and from the perspective of our professional partners, the value is having someone in the child's life who has that really special rapport with the young person, but then who also has the platform to be able to share with the court through their written reports, for example, or in real time with the social worker if the child has perhaps a need that hasn't been met yet.
So they would work perhaps with the social worker. We know, or we can assume, that social workers' cases are inundated. This person could also speak on behalf of the child to the social worker, and hopefully the social worker would consider the information relevant, good content to listen to, or advice.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We're really grateful for the role that social workers play in the lives of our children. But as you point out, social workers are trying to serve the needs of many children at one time. And so that's another way that CASA volunteers can be really critical in the life of a child in foster care, because as a volunteer, CASAs are only working with one child or one sibling group at a time. And so unlike social workers or other professionals, they're not trying to balance the caseload. They get to singularly focus in on that one particular child. And so as a result, the CASA may notice or observe things that perhaps haven't been shared with the social worker yet, and the CASA can speak up and share that information to assist the social worker in serving the child.
Let me reintroduce our guest is Jessica Munoz. She's the Executive Director for Voices for Children. Who do you typically see is the volunteers? Are they the retired seniors? Are they the young professionals? Are they in between? Who is the person that most commonly see playing this role as the volunteer?
So, Lillian, it's actually yes to all of those.
Okay.
Certainly, many of our volunteers are retired or perhaps later in their careers. Maybe they're empty nesters who are accustomed to having part of their time spent with their own children and engaged in their activities. But we also have wonderful volunteers who maybe are a few years into their career and haven't taken on additional life responsibilities yet, and they find that they have some time to give back and to serve a child in this way. And I have to tell you, we have volunteers who are right there in the middle with full-time jobs and kids of their own, but who feel called to advocate for a child in foster care. And so they, too, will sign up to attend an information session, get to know a little bit more about the role of a volunteer, ultimately decide to enter training, and then do excellent, excellent jobs advocating for children.
To fund your organization, how many employees do you have that then work with the volunteers?
So we have a staff of 11 employees. Almost all of them work directly with our volunteers. There are a couple of us who are in management or outreach roles. But really, the core of our team are our supervisors who work directly with our volunteers. And of course, it's the volunteers who are providing the direct service to children.
Right.
So by comparison, we have 10 staff, but we have more than 300 volunteers who are serving kids in Riverside County.
So volunteers in your world are essential. It is how you are able to serve these children.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All the kids would be in foster care, and so the volunteer would be working with the foster parent, a social worker, and the child?
That's right. So the CASA is advocating for the child, of course, but our kids have lots of adults in their lives, including caregivers as well as social workers. Many of the children we serve, the goal for their case is to hopefully reunify with their family of origin if it's healthy and safe for that to happen. And so in those instances, our volunteers may even be working with the child's parents as well.
You've been doing this for a while. What is a common reason, or maybe the most common reason, why children are removed from their home, or does it really vary?
You know, certainly every child's story is different. And families may face challenges for all kinds of reasons, especially during the difficult times in which we find ourselves living. In many of the cases that we see, children have been removed because of neglect. Perhaps there are parents in the child's life who are struggling with substance abuse or mental health issues, or maybe there's even domestic violence in the home. And some of those struggles have risen to the level of interfering with the parent's ability or capacity to provide care for their kids. When kids are removed, in most cases, parents are offered services so that hopefully the family can reunify in a safe and healthy way.
Will you share maybe a happier outcome that you have witnessed over the years?
I think happy outcome looks like a lot of different things depending on the child's situation.
Sure.
It's always really a joy when our CASAs come alongside kids whose parents have decided to really participate in services so that the family can reunify. We love when kids can go home to their families of origin. In some circumstances, it's not possible for that to happen. So we also really celebrate when kids are able to find a forever home through adoption or guardianship. And in the instances where our kids will spend time in foster care until they become adults, our CASAs can be really instrumental in supporting their ability to live independently. We had a CASA just recently who hadn't been on her case very long. She was assigned to an older teen who was really interested in finding a part-time job, even though in today's environment, it's so difficult to do. Her CASA assisted her, helped her fill out job applications, and a couple months was able to find a job at a fast food restaurant so she could start saving a little bit of money and prepare for independence. All of those outcomes are happy for different reasons.
Sure.
But part of what makes the outcome so happy oftentimes is that their CASA has gotten to know the child on a one-on-one basis. And so as important decisions are being made, the CASA is helping to ensure that the child's needs and wishes for the future and for a happy outcome, whatever that might be, is really heard by everyone involved who's making decisions.
If somebody today decided they would like to do that, they're going to go through the background, the training, and so forth that you've described. How long does it take? Is that a 3-month period, 4-month period, 2-week period? What does that take for someone to say, this is what I want to do? How quickly is the turnaround?
I would say that it's probably about 6 to 8 weeks, depending on the timing. So we offer an Advocate University training session almost every month.
Okay.
In the past, and was offered live, we would rotate the communities in which we were holding the training. Right now, because of COVID and everything being online, every training is online, and so prospective volunteers don't necessarily have to wait for the training to be offered in a location that's convenient for them. So if somebody were interested in becoming a CASA volunteer, they could today visit our website, speakupnow.org, attend an online information session, which is an opportunity to hear more about what we do and the role of a CASA volunteer, join our next online training, and within a week or two of successful completion, be matched with a child. So it really could be a 6 to 7 week process, perhaps.
Because of COVID, I don't know how you fundraise. I don't know if you throw events or galas or what you might do. But how have you had to either reinvent, pivot, or maybe you don't do fundraising?
So we absolutely fundraise. One of the misconceptions about our program is that because we do work so closely with the court, sometimes there's an assumption that we're paid for by the court or county, and that's not the case. We're an independent, private, nonprofit organization that has an agreement with the court that allows us to do the work that we do. But that does mean that we have to raise every dollar necessary to train and support our volunteers well. So we fundraise from a variety of sources, as you can imagine, individuals, businesses, foundation, and grants. And just like so many other aspects of our life, the economic positions of many of our funders has shifted or changed. And so we've had to become that much more assertive about making sure that we tell the story of the incredible impact that our CASA volunteers have on the lives of children, because despite the pandemic, we're absolutely committed to continuing to advocate for kids to use creativity and technology when we need to do that, and to make sure that we continue to match children who might be in foster care and would benefit from a CASA to a dedicated community volunteer.
So the volunteers, are they having to work with the kids virtually? Is that how they're doing it as well?
Yes. So typically our volunteers would see their kids in person and go on outings. Now, in some cases, volunteers are meeting with kids and caregivers virtually, attending meetings that way, even court that way.
And how have the kids, the youth, adjusted to seeing their CASA person virtually? Are they been all in, or are they missing that one-to-one?
They miss the one-to-one and that in-person connection. That's a really special part of the program. However, I really give a lot of credit to our volunteers for creatively adapting to the virtual environment and coming up with fun ways to engage kids virtually to keep them interested and entertained. Sometimes they'll do crafts together with our older kids. They might even cook over FaceTime. So there's lots of different ways that they've tried to maintain that connection.
Very good. Okay, Jessica, thank you so much for your time and your service with CASA and all your staff for what you're doing for our kids in foster care.
It's our privilege, Lillian. Thank you so much for having me.
To learn more about Voices for Children and the CASA program, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles and click on today's show. My guest is Adam Monahan. He is the longtime producer of the popular PBS show, Antiques Roadshow. Antiques Roadshow airs on KVCR-TV Fridays at 8 p.m. Today, we're talking with Adam about another project related to Antiques Roadshow, but it takes a slight detour. Adam is the host of the new podcast, Detours. Welcome to Lifestyles.
Thank you, Lillian. Thanks for having me. I think you called me the producer. I'm definitely a producer. My boss might have some, or maybe you said a producer. I can't tell.
I said that, but I knew you were going to correct that, so that's fine, too.
I just don't want to get yelled at. This is my first ever radio appearance, so thank you very much for having me.
Okay, well, we're going to go with the producer and knowing that there are others for sure. As a longtime producer of Antiques Roadshow, you've had the inside track of what's going on during and after the show. Tell me about this new podcast, Detours. How did it come about, and what's the premise?
I've worked on permanently for Roadshow since 2004, and one of my primary jobs working for GBH's Antiques Roadshow, and I still do a lot of the fact-checking for the show. It's now handled by a lot more people than myself, but every time we would do something, you know, you'd learn more about an object than we can do in an appraisal. An appraisal on our TV show is about 3 to 4 minutes, maybe a long one's 5 minutes. And there's just so many stories that happen after our cameras leave town, and you learn more. Like our first episode is that we called The Hardest Fact I Ever Checked was about a flag that came into New Orleans event that we had. It came in from a great-grandson of Patrick McMahon, who was on JFK's boat, the PT-109. Hmm. And the story goes that this was actually a flag that was gifted from JFK to McMahon when he was recovering in the hospital from wounds he sustained when the PT-109 crashed. After the show, we were all excited and stuff like that. But then when we started researching and doing the fact-checking, we're like, we don't know if this is really from the PT-109. And things like that happen on our show, I mean, where you just have to check what's happened and it takes you down the rabbit hole. You wind up learning a lot more about each object. And that's where this developed, the idea that we could tell more stories in a podcast than we have the ability to on the TV program.
As you're talking about fact-checking for Roadshow when you're doing it, and now you've said there's so many more people just doing fact-checking, how much time will you spend on some of these? Because the show is being shot right there. We've done it here in California in Palm Springs, where our sister station KVCR-TV has been a part of. So is the fact-checking going on then?
No, and that's the point of it. What happens at a show is that our appraisers have a base of knowledge. They know what objects are worth. They know a history of it, but they have a limited time to do their research on set. For those who don't know how an Antiques Roadshow works, people come with their item, say I have a vase, and I bring it up to an appraiser table with my vase. Most times, 99%, they're just going to tell you what that item is, what it's worth right there and then. We have thousands of people come to our event. Out of those, we get 50, 80 that actually get recorded for television. That's out of thousands. An appraiser will then ask for a producer if it's something really special, if it's a story they think they can tell for television. They'll ask for a producer, and the producer will come eventually to them and learn what they want to go on TV with. They'll interview the appraiser and the guest separately and decide to take that on the air. From that moment, the appraiser has maybe 30 minutes to get themselves, they get makeup done, they have to go to the bathroom one last time, whatever it is, they don't have much time before they go on camera with that item. But there is a brief period of research where they try to get their ducks in a row. After the program, when we watch an edited appraisal, because they might tape for 8 to 10 minutes, we have to cut that into a consumable 3 to 5 minutes. When we do that, then we go into the fact-checking in post-production to make sure that all of the information is correct.
Got it. For Detours, the podcast, you are taking some of the stories. How are you picking your stories? There's so many to choose from that you decide, hey, let's follow up a little deeper and see what the reality is of this. Or how are you doing that process?
Well, the podcast developed on the idea that we would want to tell stories where we learned more after the cameras left town. But from 24 years of production, we have all these stories in our minds of stuff that we remember learning about. We asked our appraisers, hey, do you remember anything that happened with some of your objects that was out of the ordinary or things you can tell us? For instance, it's kind of legendary around here, but there was one time that they had the FBI called after a program. So we all remember it is that there was an Edgar Allan Poe daguerreotype, an image of Edgar Allan Poe that came into the show that we later learned was stolen once the FBI called us.
Oh.
So that immediately became a story that we wanted to do. What was great about this one, this is our third episode. It's available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from, but nobody remembered it. It was so long ago that we heard this, found out it was stolen, and eventually returned to the proper owner. It was fun to piece it together what went down, but that's just one of those stories you hear about. But coming up with these ideas, they're all ideas that we kind of had in our head just from working here so long. And then also soliciting our appraisers to say, hey, do you have a good story to share about an object? And they've been very helpful.
Let me reintroduce our guest is podcast host Adam Monahan. He's also one of the producers for the PBS show Antiques Roadshow. So, Adam, when you reached back to these guests, are you talking originally to the person that came on Antiques Roadshow, or are you just following up about that item?
Some of them you are following up with the original guest. Unfortunately, the person who did own the Edgar Allan Poe daguerreotype I just spoke of, she passed a few years ago. But the other episodes we did contact the owners who came into the show and we recorded. So that person who brought that flag from the PT-109 was a huge part of our first episode, the one where we try to figure out if this flag was in fact the flag from the PT-109. So his name was Luke. We interviewed him. We were fortunate that Luke also lent us his flag again to get it chemically tested to see if it had elements that we thought might be in a flag that would have been on JFK's boat. So he was a great sport with us, worked more with us. Our most recent episode is called Carolyn's Next Chapter, and Carolyn Hollander was a guest we met in Churchill Downs in Kentucky. And what she had brought to our show was a book from her, I want to say was it her grandfather or great-grandfather, but this was a book that had came through her family that documented all these items that were stolen in the Holocaust. And she had come to the show with a pocket watch, which was the only surviving item they had that was brought over from Germany to America. Her mission right now is she's trying to get other things that were documented from this book through doing research that she knows was stolen during the Holocaust. So we talked to Carolyn to figure out what she's doing right now. And she's in touch with the FBI. Her appraiser at Roadshow, Jeff Cohen, spoke to her after the show and he got her in touch with the FBI. And now she's doing research to try to get items back. And that's the story that we share with people in the podcast detours.
So, you know, with Antiques Roadshow and your detours, you are learning. It's just in a fun way, because when I watch Antiques Roadshow, and I do, I like the sports stuff when you have baseball autograph something, you know, or there's a sports related. And so you are learning, and hopefully we're learning all the right stuff. Is there been times when maybe the information wasn't accurate that was put out and you guys have to do something with that?
Well, first of all, I love that you said sports, because sports are like one of the easiest categories to fact check. Huh. All the stats are there. The history is written down so much and well documented about how many home runs Hank Aaron had this year. And so I actually love sports appraisals. Yeah, we do have items that we have to make corrections on. And there is, for season two or an upcoming season of Detours, I don't know when I'll get to make this, one of our most famous cases was about a face jug. And a face jug is this grotesque looking form of pottery. But this came into a show years ago. And after we aired this episode, somebody said, wait a minute, that's not from the 1800s. My friend from high school made that. And sure enough, we had to go speak to the person who we thought made it, and they sent pictures of their time as a potter in high school, and they made all types of grotesque potteries like this, but it was executed so well.
Wow.
That it had all the properties of an 1800s face jug, and we had no clue, and we had to air a correction on air to say this is actually done in the 1970s. Oh. Things like that do happen. We find things out after the show and do have to correct it. It goes along with anybody who produces television. You know, you're going to air some stuff that you do your best to check it beforehand, and then there's something like that escapes you.
My guest is podcast host Adam Monahan. He's also one of the producers of the PBS popular show Antiques Roadshow. Adam, thanks so much. I hope Detours goes well for you in the next season, and Antiques Roadshow continues on public television for many years to come.
Thank you, Leanne. I appreciate you having me on.
To learn more about the Detours podcast or Antiques Roadshow, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles and click on today's show. That's our show for this week. To hear any of our past shows, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. You can also listen to Lifestyles on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play Music. Search for Lifestyles with Lillian Vasquez on your streaming service and take the show on the go. If you have a topic or an idea for a segment, leave me a message at our website. You know it, kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. Thanks to all who helped to make this show possible, including Sharina Wadd, David Fleming, Sean Houlihan, Andrew Caravella, and executive producer Rick Dulock. Our theme music is provided by Ethan Bortnick. Join me next week at the same time for Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez. Bye for now.